picked out some articles, and I've picked out some of your more interesting tweets. I also listened to it was like a year ago with friend of the show, Jason Miles, your This Is Revolution podcast. And I found it to be charming because it was like the beginning of what's now called the Mamdani moment.
Yeah.
You know, and you guys were unpacking the way that Eric Adams was trying to use his blackness to like disarm Mamdani's political stances, you know. I found that to be very interesting a year on, right?
Because
you know what happened. So what's your take on that from the UK? It seems like we've started recording now. Everyone, we're here with Ralph Leonard from the UK, Nigerian British author and co-host of Alt Black podcast. Do I have that correct?
Yeah. I'm a participant. Yeah.
A participant. I like that. Welcome to the show. So the first question we had for you was, what do you make of this Mamdani moment? What do you make of Mayor Eric Adams eating shit?
Well, part of me is like kind of happy he won just so that people like Eric Adams can eat his own feces. And, you know, because especially in the lead up to the election, there was a lot of like really horrible stuff being like pumped out against Mamdani, like really like explicitly like racist, like anti-Muslim stuff being pumped out. So in a sense, I was like happy one just to kind of just put the boot back against
the eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But then obviously politically speaking, it's like Mamdani is, even though he is like a democratic socialist, he's like a kind of progressive. That's what he's kind of tapping into. He's like, I suppose, what, you know, he's clearly like playing into like a post Bernie kind of moment, right? And in that sense, he's like the first big electoral victory of the millennial left, especially because he himself is a millennial and he's like younger. He, you know, the way he campaigned with his videos, he's got that kind of soft charisma about him.
Yeah.
It's like, it's very subtle. Like, it's not like very obvious, but he has the kind of, he's very affable, you know, has this nice smile. And he, I suppose, for, you know, a lot of like, I suppose, disaffected like leftists, like he speaks to them very specifically, and that's why he's kind of part of this kind of left populism sort of thing. So yeah.
so you would have voted for him if only to like to stick it to the Andrew Cuomo. And it's fascinating to get someone's view on this stuff. From where do you live? London?
Well, I live Reading, which is close-ish. It's close to London.
Reading. So to get your opinion all the way from there, that was something that both Andy and I were tickled by, is that our local political race became like a big deal. So you would have voted for Mamdani. Did you vote, Andy? You didn't vote, did you?
No, I would. I probably would have if it was close, but I'm not registered in the city at the moment.
I would have just voted for him just to stick it to the racists, if you like.
I think most people. Yeah, and you know, the thing you mentioned about Eric Adams is interesting, because he did go down in flames, but it took quite a while. And for the first half of his mayoralty, I think, you know, when sort of accusations of his poor governance and then later his blatant corruption started to accumulate, he would often answer these by attacking white journalists for coming at a black man in those terms. Like there's one quote where he's like, I'm not your slave. We're not on the plantation. You can't talk to me like this. And that specific thing was about him like gutting Section 8 housing or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like something just totally horrendous that he needs to be questioned about. But that stuff played really well on black social media. You know, a lot of black New Yorkers really appreciated someone standing up for themselves like that. So I think he did very well in his career of, you know, being an identifiable, strong black man, standing up for himself, standing up for black constituencies. It's remarkable he lost that so quickly.
Yeah. What impressions did you get, Ralph, from all the way over there in the UK? I'm saying the letters U and K, not like the new portmanteau of like Y O O K.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that later. But what did you think in the UK about Eric Adams and his blackness and how that played out?
Oh, it was interesting from my perspective that clearly, like, black Americans, or I should say, like, native born black Americans are like a loyal constituency of the Democrats. And clearly, like, Eric Adams is like leaning into that, I guess, strategy to keep his hold on power, was like just rely on black Americans as like a client constituency of the Democrats. And, you know, clearly, like, the official, quote unquote, official communal institutions of black Americans, like churches and stuff like that, will always swing towards the Democrats, because that's like they're the status quo, like, institutions. And but it did point to, like, one of the reasons Mamdani won, it seemed to me, was that New York politics was just so corrupt. And so, like, it wasn't just Eric Adams. You had Andrew Cuomo, who's like got octopus hands, if you know what I mean. Like, he's such a dirty little politician.
Yeah, he's nasty. He's a nasty man, as Trump would say, nasty.
And, you know, Andrew Cuomo was also doing this kind of, in his campaign, like, leaning into identity politics.
Wearing Italian face?
Yeah, like, he was doing the whole Italian thing, that weird, like, the real New Yorkers. He's doing that sort of thing. And also, like, when he would try to campaign amongst, like, the Jewish community, he would lean into, like, Israel-Palestine and say, like, you know, Mamdani supports terrorism, all this nonsense. Like,
it was such a heady mix. It was such a heady brew of all the worst parts of our politics. And I use the term "our" advisedly there, because I feel like you're British, we're American. Obviously, we're cousins, right? Like, that's the whole idea. You had a really interesting tweet the other day, and this is not going to be a referendum on your tweets, this podcast, but I found it interesting, which is you said something to the effect of, let me pull the actual thing up, because I don't want to put words in your mouth here. I have under there in my notes, what did he mean by this? You know, like, that's like a common phrase that people use online. I think I know what you mean by this. Okay, so what you're doing, this is from a few days ago. You said that most American quirks, and you were talking about trial by jury, of your, you say most American quirks originated in England, and then you follow that up with, that's why America, emphasis is the English Republic, sublated, of course, in this way. And I'll ask you to unpack this a little bit. We are cousins in more ways than one, right? People want to talk about it in terms of culture or national ethnicity or whatever, but politically and economically, we're very much cousins. What do you mean by the American Republic is the English Republic sublated? What does that mean to you?
I would say that the American Revolution, in a sense, is a continuation of the English Revolution in the in the 17th century. We had our revolution, the Civil War, the Cromwellian Revolution, the Levellers, the Diggers, people like that. And that's where, and obviously it came, all culminated in 1689, the Glorious Revolution, where William of Orange came through and deposed the Stuarts and the Restoration. And we came up with the new settlement that's more or less existed since then, which is kind of constitutional monarchy, right? So that is, if you will, England's bourgeois revolution. And the American Revolution is a continuation of it, but I say sublated in the sense that when you see this, you know, in the Declaration of Independence, that what the American Revolution did is take the whole idea of the rights of Englishmen, because before the revolution, that's how they kind of thought of themselves. We're Britishmen and we're subject to English liberty.
And the term is the natural born rights of Englishmen, right? There's something natural about those rights.
Right? Yeah. And what the founding fathers did through their Enlightenment kind of ideas was take rights of Englishmen and raise it to the rights of man. So it's not just this kind of narrow national or even ethnocentric sort of conception of rights, but it was a universal, right? And that's how, even in, because we have our own kind of mythology in England about this, about the rights of Englishmen, that, you know, that, you know, because the common law goes all the way back to the Anglo-Saxons, and it could, so to speak, imminent within our peoplehood, our sort of particular experience as a people. And, you know, there's where trial by jury, things, free speech, all that, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's a legal fiction. It's a historical fiction. It's a mythology. Mm-hmm. And these things kind of have a way of saying that our liberties are ancient. And this is something that bourgeois theorists kind of talk about. It's not just in England, because you can find like Madame de Stael in France, or Augustin Thierry, who's the French historian in after the Restoration. They kind of have a way of saying that our bourgeois liberties are ancient, go all the way back to the late high medieval ages. And that's how they kind of imagine
it's a way to legitimize what are actually new claims, very like kind of modern claims, let's call them, of like of the universality of these things, is to say that they're legitimate because they're old.
Yeah, and it's like, because even the idea of the free-born Englishman, it's a 17th century idea. It was created by a leveler, right? Because that's how they, so to speak, made their claims that our rights go all the way back to Magna Carta, when they were actually expressing something new, right? That you something the, you know, the rise of bourgeois social relations over feudal or aristocratic ones. That's how they made that claim. And, you know, E.P. Thompson, right, who the great like English socialist, like he wrote in his book The Making of the English Working Class, he talked about how, like, you know, in the 18th century you had like a kind of this idea of freeborn Englishmen was how like plebeian radicals would make their claims against like the aristocracy and so on, because, you know, this is a very common thing, like, and that, of course, those plebeians were of course expressing a bourgeois consciousness, but it was kind of a plebeian.
They grasped into the past to try to again give this a legitimacy that like the modern world maybe hadn't come up with secularized, universalized ideals yet, so they had to express it in this way. See, when you look at your header, let's say on the Everything app, and it says conservative Marxist, you know, people's heads might explode. I think I know what you mean by that. I'm doing Donald Trump hands. I'm sorry, I'm doing that. I'm from New York too. Like it, there's a way in which that scrambles people's ideas, and they're like, "Oh, well, this guy must be reactionary, or he must be a nationalist. There must be something to that." So, is that what you mean by conservative Marxist? Is in that like you look to the maybe the 19th century, the bourgeois revolutions and their aftermath, and like the socialism of say pre-20th century? What does it mean to you to be conservative in this sense? Is it a provocation?
Yeah, it's funny because I annexed that very phrase from Christopher Hitchens because he used that phrase. But I'm using
your take on the Iraq War, Ralph?
Huh?
What's your take on the Iraq War?
Oh, I'm against it.
Just a second. Yes, yeah, you already beat Hitchens at his own game. Okay, so you appropriated it from Christopher Hitchens, who, as we know, was a Marxist, right?
Mm-hmm. But I'm using it in a very different sense, in the sense that I want to conserve, if you will, the historical memory of Marxism, because Marxism, as I understand it, like revolutionary Marxism, really disintegrated 1914, right? August 4th, 1914. And I'm getting this from George Lichtheim, who wrote a good biography of Lukács. He said that classical Marxism disintegrated in the decade between August 4th, 1914 and 1924, which is when Lenin died and Stalin started to rise into power. And I would sort of extend that to say that the residues, whatever residues of that remained, well and truly died when Trotsky died in 1940. Because obviously Trotsky kind of tried to resuscitate. That's the whole point of Trotskyism, is to try to resuscitate like the classical Marxism that fell into crisis in that era.
To conserve something of classical Marxism, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's what its original goals were.
Are we talking specifically about like the internationalist aspect of Marxism? Because we're talking about 1914, we're talking about the Zimmerwald split, you know, voting for the war credits to support World War I. And then there's an internationalist split that includes the Bolsheviks. And then the death of Lenin in the consolidation of Stalinism is the socialism in one country, right?
Yeah. There's the internationalist aspect. There's also, if you will, it's Marxism's roots in the Enlightenment and the bourgeois revolution. Also, I would provoke people and say Marxism's anarchist goals, if you will, that in the sense that the end point or the end zeal of Marxism is the abolition of the state or the withering of the state. Well, the capitalist state is what's abolished. It's the proletarian state that withers away. People often get those things confused. But since then, like, Marxism's been distorted as a way to like rationalize, you know, social democracy or Stalinism, which is social dictatorship, right? It's the way of rationalizing a kind of paternalistic statist ideology in a way that, you know, the classical Marxist revolutionaries would not have recognized, because every one of them, Marx, Engels, Luxembourg, Lenin,
Debs.
Trotsky, Eugene Debs, you know, all of them all believed that the end point, the ultimate end point, was the abolition of the state so that society can govern itself. And this is where, if you will, Marxism and liberalism, or classical liberalism for want of a better phrase, there's a kind of resonance with, a kind of parallel with, because, you know, liberalism has this idea of subordinating the state to civil society and the gradual withering away of that kind of coercion, that the government is a necessary evil for now, but maybe, you know, society can develop through exchange and cooperation to a state where the state becomes unnecessary, right? That's where anarchism comes from. Like, anarchism is like radicalized liberalism in the aftermath of liberalism's disintegration, or I suppose mutation, in the early 19th century, 1830s, pretty much. So, and Marxism agrees with that. But it says, in order to begin that process, the working class has to come to power and achieve the dictatorship of the proletariat, which is like a temporary minimum state that is ultimately necessary to overcome, you know, the contradiction of bourgeois right, as Lenin says in the State and Revolution. So that's the Marxist hypothesis that I wish to conserve, if you will.
See, it is a provocation, because when you like the what you say, when you explain yourself, you're very much on this wreckage ground. And then, you know, people see your header and maybe they think you're more on like some other ground. But I think that Andy and I, the project we've been working on for how many years has it been, Andy? How many years have we had this podcast?
7 years.
7 years is working out a lot of these questions that you're working on too. So I'm very glad that to have you on this on our podcast today. Andy, did you have any questions about the conservatism stuff?
Yeah, it's a really interesting framing of it. I mean, it's kind of it seems like counterposed to the conception of orthodox Marxism, right? Which I guess it's different than what you're talking about. And I wonder if you see that term conservative Marxism replicated in any tendencies or movements. Like, obviously Trotskyism continues after Trotsky. The new left takes up these questions of the state and kind of reformulates Leninism, returns to Leninism in different ways. Like, do you see some sort of natural allies out there in the leftist ether for this way of thinking?
I suppose, because I would say that my thing is like more post-Trotskyist, because before I came to my position, I was part, like, a fellow traveler with a Trotskyist group in England called Workers' Liberty.
Uh-huh.
You know, a Chapmanite, Draperite type group Early Chapman, I must stress. Early Chapman, not the later one.
Not a liquidationist group, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And in America, their analog would be the publication New Politics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so that's... Andy, you're familiar? I'm not familiar with New Politics, but...
Yeah, this is kind of Draperite. Yeah, post-Trotskyism, yeah. C.L.R. James, too, which I know you've written about, Facing Reality. Yeah, this is stuff that we like.
Yeah, I suppose, like, who am I, like, sympathetic to? Like, I suppose I'm sympathetic, but not completely with, like, Platypus in America. I'm sympathetic, like, yeah, there's, I'm sympathetic with that, with them. There's, I mean, even Hitchens, there are aspects that I sympathize with, even though I don't agree with the ultimate conclusion of where he went to, but I do get it in the sense that he comes after, like, the new left, right? Mm-hmm. And if you will, the new left tried to, if you will, resuscitate it, but it failed ultimately. And that's why Hitchens then became like a kind of progressive leftist. And then after 9/11, we know the story. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because he wrote in his memoir about this, like in the aftermath of the Carnation Revolution in Portugal.
Portugal, yeah.
Yeah. And interesting revolution to read about, I should say. And he was saying that because ultimately Portugal moved into like a bourgeois liberal democratic government, like he was saying, maybe me being a Marxist, I came in at like not at the beginning of something new, but like at the end of it, like its last like flares. This was what the new left was like the last sparks of what remained of Marxism, rather than trying to, if you will, reformulate it in a new way. So yeah.
And so this is where you'd argue that he becomes a post-Trotskyist himself. He becomes, that makes sense. He was mugged by reality, as you know.
Yeah, that was his way of being.
His way of being. you mentioned Lukács. And I read one of your essays. I've had the pleasure to read a bunch of your essays. One was it was in Unheard, which is not a publication that I read much, for better or for worse. It's very UK oriented. And I'll be honest, you guys, your whole situation over there, and I do want to talk about this, it seems all fucked up. Like, I try not to like look at the UK too much because it's like kind of sad to me. But one of the things you write is about how working at McDonald's made you into a Marxist. So you had your Marxist moment, and maybe this is like symptomatic of where you've gone since then, with your encounter with wage labor, with your encounter with the corporate world and working. So tell us a little bit about working at McDonald's and alienation and how it kind of put you on the path you're on today.
Like, because I suppose... when I was younger, that was like, you know, a job that I had. And before then, I was already kind of interested in like radical ideas, but I was more like into like kind of Stirnerite anarchism. And so I wasn't like completely a socialist. But then working in McDonald's, like with wage labor, obviously, I could see it through like this anarchist kind of view about like authority, you know, the how hierarchical it is, the authoritarianism, how you're surveyed all the time, you know, and, you know, the idea of the division of labor. You feel like you're stupid, dumb, like you're just like a machine doing something. And yeah, I could feel it now. It wasn't just like an intellectual like abstraction. I could on the sense feel it. While on the other hand, there's also the other side of it, which is like a kind of classical liberal thing about, you know, you earn your own living, you work for your, that's how you earn your rights as a person, derived from your ability to work. That's where our civil rights come from. That's like the entire basis of our society. And I could sense feel this contradiction. How come I don't feel free from working? And
right. It's a necessity and you didn't feel freedom out of it.
Yeah. And that's where I saw, like, it was like the beginning of, you know, me becoming like a socialist before even becoming really a Marxist in that sense. Because then I, you know, like became very interested in all sorts of ideas, you know, like socialism. And then remember when I first read Marx, the Communist Manifesto, and it hit me. It just made complete. Yeah, this is for me. Yeah,
you were, as the kids say these days, one-shotted.
Yeah,
one-shotted by Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto.
Mm-hmm. And the most interesting about the manifesto was two parts. The first bit, which is where it's like, gives all this praise to the revolutionary achievements of the bourgeoisie, and then the bit where he criticizes all the other product, you know, socialists, the aristocratic socialists, the true socialists, the Christian socialism,
conservative socialists.
Yeah, conservative socialists. yeah. So that was like interesting. It's like, Marx is a communist, but he's critical of other socialists. That's interesting. That's what made me intrigued. It was like, why did he do it? What was the point behind it? Why? How could he be like an imminent critic of socialism to criticize socialism for the sake of socialism, if you know what I mean? That,
yes.
Like, he recognized like socialism was like an authentic expression of the crisis that capitalism represented. That on the one hand, you have these bourgeois social relations that we're all intertwined within. But then in the era of the Industrial Revolution, there's this kind of contradiction between them. Because on the one hand, you gain your freedom through work, but then people are becoming unemployed permanently, like as a permanent class through the Industrial Revolution. But on the other hand, you know, that crisis also points to a new potential, a new form of society that is possible. And how can we be true to that spirit? That's what I think kind of Marxism was trying to grapple with in his like critique of socialism, if you will.
Absolutely. I think it's only with time that I've gained an appreciation of exactly that part of the manifesto that you're talking about. There was a way in which it seemed like after the great financial crisis, mm-hmm. and Andy and I were both kind of active a little bit after that together, the two of us. And I'm not sure how old you are, Ralph.
I'm 29.
So you're substantially younger. So the great financial crisis happened for you when you were quite young, when you were like a teenager. It happened for Andy and I when we were in our 20s, I think, right? And there was a way in which it seemed like to be engaged with Marxism was to be engaged with like uncovering or unfurling an understanding of political economy that leads to this telos, that like the crisis has happened now and we're kind of riding the tiger, and the working class, you know, spontaneously, it seemed like, was going to act in various ways that was going to bring about the end, you know, the end of this thing and the beginning of something new. And it was easy to see that through the teens, you know, through the 20 teens. There were all these movements, there were all these riots, there were all these insurrections, there were all these general strikes or whatever, as working people and middle class people were trying to defend what they had. Now we like crash up against the shores of the 2020s, and it feels as though, you know, at least for me anyways, that politics starts to become interesting again, at least in the age of Bernie Sanders and Trump. And it seems like the big riot, the big social movement that we have, especially here in the United States, is one that Black Lives Matter in 2020, which takes a form that isn't necessarily very conducive to socialism, at least at an end point, right? And so the question of like, why is socialism necessary? What is it that Marx and Engels say in the manifesto? Is it possible that we already have socialism, that socialism, like a reactionary paternalistic welfare statism, you know, that passes itself as socialism, is actually necessary due to the crises of capitalism? And I think it is. And I think that Marxist project in this decade and decades moving forward, I think you would call it conserving. Maybe I would use that term too, but like excavating or uncovering like authentic, I hate that word, authentic Marxist politics that might actually call for like the sublation of capitalism and capitalist politics, as opposed to like purely a negation of those things. So I feel you on that front. Go ahead.
I'll say that we also have to kind of recognize, as far as like proletarian socialism, that we are starting from ground zero, in that sense that we have to kind of earn the right to become proletarian socialists who have the goal to take power in the core of capitalism to achieve like the global dictatorship of the proletariat. That's a big deal, and we have to kind of recognize where we're starting from, and there's like you have to kind of build your way through, you know, because initially you are going to start out from like, if you will, a kind of popular democratic liberal kind of ideas, you know, that's where it's going to start. But how do you get from that to proletarian socialism? And that's, I think, where we have to kind of start doing and understand that it is going to take time. There's not a magic click of the finger and it's going to do its thing. And neither is it, this is why I also kind of, I'm critical of people who say that, well, China will sort it out. The Chinese Communist Party is like the dictatorship of the proletariat. And it's like, yeah, okay. But are they trying to spread socialism in, you know, in the United States or in the West or something like in the core of capitalism itself? No, they're not. Are
the workers in power in China?
Yeah, no, they're not in power. It's the bureaucratic caste that's in power in China.
Go ahead, Ed.
Back to the McDonald's essay, because this is, you know, a story that I really recognize in my own past, because I was an anarchist who worked, and then I went to the New School with Sean and read Marx, and I graduated, and I went back to the same job as doing food delivery at a restaurant. And, you know, I had the same critique of wage labor and work and capitalism that I did before, but Marxism really helped me understand the certain dogmas of that kind of neo-anarchism that I grew up with were incorrect. Specifically, like, you know, I worked at different restaurants. I noticed that the management at some restaurants was very good and helpful.
Yeah.
And the management at other restaurants was terrible. Whereas before I just had this attitude of like, there shouldn't be managers.
Mm.
We should run the restaurant ourselves or something like that. And, you know, Marx has a more thoroughgoing understanding of how capitalism works and how work works. And so, you know, if the restaurant were self-managed and there were no bosses or whatever, there would still be some of the same contradictions playing out with like different kinds of roles. So Marxism really helped me understand, you know, helped me deepen my critique of work in a way. And then moving on to like Facing Reality, C.L.R. James and stuff, there's this kind of interest in that sort of proletarian outlook of, you know, believing that the class struggle begins every day at the factory or the workplace.
Yeah.
So it's a very subjective experience, like the molecular aspects of the way capitalism works as a international, transnational phenomenon can be seen in just anyone's day-to-day job or something like that.
One thing that also helped me understand Marxism better was reading the, I suppose, bourgeois precursors to Marx. So Adam Smith, for example, Wealth of Nations, Hegel, Kant, Rousseau, right? Even someone like Benjamin Constant, like in this, that helped me kind of understand where Marx is coming from, because obviously he quotes Adam Smith a lot in Capital. He obviously, Hegel is like a big influence, you know. You have Kant in the sense that what those high enlightenment philosophers understood was what was new about the society that they were living in compared to what came before. And, you know, they, you know, this idea of a commercial society, you know, that society based on commodity production that had become generalized, and where, you know, laborers, free labor, you know, private property, and not just private property in the vulgar sense that libertarians talk about, but in the sense that your labor is the most primitive form of private property that anybody can have. That's why labor is a form of capital, right? In capitalism, labor is capital. And that kind of helped me understand this contradiction that, you know, that I am like also an object, but also a subject.
Mm-hmm.
That's, and capitalism kind of distorts that kind of dialectical relationship in such a way that that's where subjectively you feel that oppression, or but then you react against that oppression in bourgeois liberal terms, right? So I want a better wage. I don't want the boss to like treat me so unfairly, you know?
You want your commodity labor power to have the value that it's meant to have, right?
Yeah.
Based on level of skills, based on how hard you work, how diligent you are.
Yeah, it's from Adam Smith directly, you know, the labor theory of values. Not Marx didn't come up with it. And what Adam Smith is talking about is that, you know, thing about Adam Smith is he's not an economist. He's a moral philosopher. So he's saying that ought to be the case, right? He's making a case that labor is the source of value, and that should be the case, that workers should be paid according to the value that they produce, right? That's what he's about. But when Marx is talking about is how that is totally distorted in capitalism. And that's why, you know, the first workers' movement read Adam Smith and was saying, "So this isn't right. I want the value of my labor." That's why the proletarian socialist movement is bourgeois in its origins, in that sense. And by bourgeois, I don't mean it in a kind of class, vulgar class sense. I mean it in the kind of form of society that we...
The mode of production, right?
Yeah,
right. The production and the political constellation of forces that arises around
them. Yeah, post-medieval society, more or less, you know.
And do you want to continue? Because you were on a roll there.
Well, no, I just... That subjective standpoint the sort of standpoint epistemology of this kind of like the class struggle begins in the workplace worldview. Like, I wonder if it needs Marx, it needs this broader proletarian outlook or engagement to become something bigger than I want better workplace conditions at my workplace, just like this isolated struggle. Like, how do you see that transforming into something bigger?
I suppose it's, have to understand capitalism as not an economic system, but as a form of society in the sense that this is where I'm influenced by Moshe Postone, because he talked about capitalism as a form of social domination, right? And it's bigger than like the workplace per se, but it's like even in stuff like, I don't know, the police, like that is a capitalist institution that was created out of the Industrial Revolution because the form of bourgeois society came into crisis. Like, that's necessitated this massive growth of the state that produces stuff like the cops, a standing army, like, which is it's so ironic because the United States has the biggest standing army in the world. Yet if you know, whereas the Second Amendment, if you actually know the history behind it, is actually meant to be an anti-militarist measure,
an antidote to a standing army. Absolutely,
yeah, it's
something that we grappled with as a country for many years. But go on,
yeah, and how basically that once you see capitalism as a society, as a social form, rather than an economic system, I think that's how people can see that there's more, you know, that we have to, if you will, do something else rather than just liberalism. Like, there's a reason why we can't just do liberalism, right?
I really like the way that you put that. I really like the terms, understanding capitalism as a social form or a social formation as opposed to an economic system. I think does a lot of work for kind of separating a vulgar Marxism or like a welfarism, the social democracy, from like a revolutionary or proletarian socialism. But your explanation, as good as it was and as productive it was, you could have just said, you know, what do we do with this? You could have just said your party, UK. I mean, you have an indigenous leftist new party arising right now around your ears. You know, I wonder, because we had Max Shanley, I'm not sure if you know who that is, on the show a couple months ago to talk about, it was the early efforts of this formation, which for people who don't know out there, listeners, I suppose it's a break from labor, the Labor Party. It's an attempt to gather those forces that have been expelled from the Labor Party, the left wing of the Labor Party, the Bennite wing, I guess, let's say, combined with, as I understand it, you can correct me, of course, on all this, combined with a sort of new and rising immigrant rights sort of left that's a response to mass migration and its backlash. There's an attempt to build your part. I hate the fucking name, but we had Max Shanley on to talk about imagining that as like a social Republican party, trying to grab it, grasp it from the hands of like Corbyn and Zoltana, I think her name is, and these like budding bureaucrats in it, and try to give it a sort of like reciprocal sort of self self-evolving nature where it can actually have like an interplay between a working class membership and a leadership. It doesn't seem like that worked out. So what's your opinion on your party as they seem to be splitting just a few months into it?
Yeah, I unfortunately, story of your party kind of like, it's like the typical leftist tale of, you know, leftist party comes up and then it starts splintering into different factions before it even gets going. Like, you know, never seen that before, unfortunately. And obviously recently there was the story of SWP members being expelled.
Oh yeah, that just happened, right? Like they were banned from the conference, but they stood up anyway and caused like a bunch of trouble for them.
And Zoltana was like against that. And she was like outside the conference, like, you know, in support of those like expelled members.
Oh, okay.
So unfortunately, it was, this was kind of inevitable, because obviously not just within the left, because also there was the so-called independent MPs, the mainly Muslim, socially conservative, like MPs who were part of the Your Party. But then there was like a lot of friction between them, especially on this issue of social conservatism. And some of them then left afterwards. Because, and especially like on social conservatism and trans rights, they didn't get on. They weren't going to sign up for that. And like, I could have seen that coming like from a long way though. And part also, because it shows that part of the reason why your party arose was also not just like immigrant rights, was also Palestine, right? Because obviously the Zoltana Corbyn wing of the Labour Party were very pro-Palestine. They got expelled, and obviously a lot of people left the Labour Party because of what Labour's policy is towards Israel, to join, because it's not just they're going to your party, there's also they're bleeding people towards the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Because not partially because of Palestine, but also Labour moving to the right on immigration, right? Because the Labour government is now taking inspiration from the Danish model, which is like leftists trying to be nativists or something like that. Social Democrats being nativists.
It's just not plausible. Yeah. Like, as always, it's not plausible, because if you're going to be a nativist, you go with the real thing. You know, that's like, Taylorism always fails. It's like Nigel Farage is right there, man. You know, Tommy Robinson's right there.
Yeah.
So they're trying to make this turn, I see. And so your party is also picking up the remnants of people leaving for that very good reason. That makes sense.
Labor is doing austerity at the same time. You know, at least the Danish party wants to conserve this like incredible social welfare state. The Labor seems to be like totally content to slash that in ways that are very obvious to everyone and people like actually feel on a quotidian level. And then they're trying to integrate like a lighter form of nativism than Farage. It's a really strangely terrible strategy.
Very bad politics, if you ask. Oh, plus also, as you have a huge budgetary crisis over there, sending billions of dollars to Ukraine and Israel as well.
Yeah. So like they want to do everything and nothing at the same time, right? Because because then even this that Labour's shift to the right on immigration, it's not going to work out for them in the end. They're done. Like, Keir Starmer is done, right? He's not he's not going to be the prime minister for the full duration of this summer. I'm convinced of that. I think he will be overthrown by the parliamentary Labour Party at some point in the next year. I'm totally to
bring
convinced.
Fucking Red Ed Miliband back, maybe, or somebody.
Yeah, it could be Andy Burnham, you know, from Manchester, the King of the North, everyone calls him.
Say again, Andy.
Who's Paul Maddock got? He's the Kingmaker.
Oh, that's true.
Could be Wes Streeting, who's like just a slightly softer version of Starmer, in my opinion. It's like, it doesn't look good.
You guys aren't, as I understand your system, you don't have to have an election for like another 4 years, right? So the Labour Party could like limp along with various different like gray-faced functionaries for years at this point.
Yeah, that's what happened with the Tories. After Boris Johnson left, Liz Truss came in without being elected by the public. Then after she failed, it was Rishi Sunak, who also wasn't elected by the public. It was the Tory party that picked the prime minister. It's very possible that that can happen with the Labour Party, that we can go through a succession of prime ministers that were not picked by, that were not democratically elected by the people. It was just like, you know, intra-party like wars that this happens, and it's just so absurd. Like, and this is why like nobody, a lot of people are just kind of like checked out of mainstream politics, and that's part one reason why reform are a force, and they're like an actual force, because a year ago nobody would have predicted that Reform UK would be de facto the right-wing opposition party, not even the Conservatives, Reform, right? And that they dictate a lot of the agenda.
Especially, are you like scared? Are you scared of Reform UK? Like, does it feel like like This Is England, like BNP rising, like the fascist hordes are at the gate? Or does it feel more ambiguous? It's hard to tell from over here. What do you think?
Reform are more ambiguous because there's like two sides of them. There's the like muscular civic nationalist bit. It's like, oh, we're not racist, but we want integration sort of thing, right? And, you know, they have like ethnic minority like members like Zia Youssef, who actually came up with their mass deportations plan. Like, yeah, the guy who came up with Reform's mass deportations plan is a brown-skinned Muslim
ambiguity, yeah.
It's interesting because also there's the online right in England that's gaining a bigger voice.
Yeah, I mean, besides the austerity and the economic questions, it seems like there's this massive pro-pogrom movement.
Yeah, especially online. You see it a lot online. And unfortunately, Elon Musk has a big influence on it because it's interesting because, you know, this word remigration.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is just a euphemism for ethnic cleansing, right? That's what it means, right? Yes. Because like a year ago, only neo-Nazis online were saying that, were using that phrase. But now it's come to say where that word, or at least the spirit behind the word, the concept behind it, is becoming more and more mainstream. Like, obviously, Donald Trump more or less used that phrase like just a couple of days ago.
Yeah, yeah. DHS is tweeting it out, and Trump is saying we're going to try to get rid of any immigrant, whether they're here legally or not, if they're not a net positive.
Did say that?
In line with Western civilization.
Yeah, which is so vague. Like, that could mean anything.
I wish America were more part of Western civilization.
Trump has been, he's mostly been like civic nationalist, and he's been able to use like criminality in order to condemn all migrants. So him moving towards like a Western civilization remigration mold is a very bad sign. I mean, I would get that from J.D. Vance. I didn't realize Trump was going that route, too.
And in England, there was even there's this Tory called Katie Lamb who said that it's not just deporting the illegals, right? We might have to deport some legal immigrants for the sake of cultural coherence.
Does that scare you personally? You were born in England, right?
Well, yeah. Well, I'm not scared because I was born in England, and also my father is white English guy. So he's Jewish as well. So it's like it's.
Oh, good. So you're somewhat inoculated from this, but I imagine that there's plenty of people who aren't,
like,
right? So
yeah, this is plenty of people aren't, but like legally, they can't really touch me, right? It's like,
what does the broader Nigerian British community feel about this kind of rhetoric? Are they aligned in some way to one of the parties or politicians?
I think most of them. It's dangerous because it's like. They clearly don't like reform for the most part. But also they're not really satisfied with like Labour and like the Tories. Obviously the leader of the Tory party is Kemi Badenoch, who is of Nigerian descent.
Yeah. You wrote an article that we read about her, but go on.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of Nigerians don't particularly like her, and especially Nigerians in the home country as well. They've taken pot shots at her. And I think a lot of Nigerians are not for the whole reform thing, but they are kind of like, look, might just for the sake that this doesn't escalate, we might have to just regulate immigration, just, you know, on a sensible level, not deport people and that stuff, but just like have control. Because, you know, a lot of people say, I support immigration. I have no problem with foreigners coming over here and integrate and all the rest of it. But we have to have controls, right? Right. And the online right they've really influenced the discourse on this for so long. Because there's this phrase they use called the Boris wave.
The Boris wave. Okay.
The Boris wave, right? Which is meant to refer to the immigrants that came post 2021, so after COVID and after Brexit had happened, more or less the Boris Johnson administration decided we're going to have to liberalize visas to, you know, a lot more immigrants from outside the European Union. So that included like Nigeria, Pakistan, so on and so forth.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but the rationale for this was like, we still need cheap labor, but we've done Brexit, yeah. So Romanians and Poles aren't going to be available anymore, so we'll get the cheap labor from elsewhere. Was that the
idea? Pretty much the idea. And the numbers, it did lead to a big increase in immigration to like the highest levels pretty much ever. So like, I think in 1 year, 2023 or 2022, it was like net migration of 900,000 people. And because like the bulk of this immigration were non-European immigrants, so non-white, and that's where the online right starts saying they get fueled by this stuff. And when you add on top the refugees and the boats, right, and you know all these kind of memes they do, like so yeah, they get really energized by it. And that's why that they hate the Conservatives as much as Labour, right? Because they say Boris is a traitor because he did all this stuff, right?
I think we're at the point right now where we're going to continue this conversation behind the paywall. Ralph, do you have like another 45 minutes or so to hang out and talk
with us? Yeah, sure.
About We can delve further into this immigration and migration question. Andy, did you have anything that to follow up with before we head behind the paywall?
Well, just wanted to remind listeners, we're running a fall promotion. So if you want to hear the rest of this episode, you can sign up at patreon.com/thiswreckage. And you can sign up at the $5 level, the $10 level. But if you pay annually, you get a 16% discount, and we will send you a copy of either Jared Shanahan's Every Fire Needs a Little Bit of Help with an intro from me, or because we only have a couple copies left of that, my book, I Want to Believe, Posadism, UFOs, and Apocalypse Communism, which is, if you were fascinated by our discussion of Trotskyism before, that's a must read for you. So you can see at patreon.com/thiswreckage, that's the pinned post, and that this is the end of the fall promotion. So get it while you can.
Get it while it's hot. And if you want to hear more of this great conversation with Ralph, where we tease out UK politics, a little bit more conservative Marxism, sign up and listen to that and all the rest of our great bonus content. Thanks for listening, and thanks Ralph for being on.
Thank you.
Awesome. Okay, now we're in the bonus section. Now we can say whatever the fuck we want. I don't know what you can say. It's different, but it doesn't feel that way.